It's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's show, Peter Cawley. Peter Cawley is a Canadian playwright who's had success around the world. He's originally from the UK, and he talks about how he got inspired by pantomimes. Of course, today his plays are performed all over the world, and the pantomime is something that got him into it when he was very, very young. If you've ever seen a pantomime, you know what I'm talking about. Pantomimes are amazingly fun productions for kids, and we talk about that in the podcast. I took my guy, Cole, to see a pantomime last year. It was Drayton Entertainment's pantomime at the Dunfield Theatre in Cambridge. And Peter's production, I'll Be Back Before Midnight, is going on right now at Drayton's Huron Country Playhouse. So if you're anywhere near southwestern Ontario, get out and see I'll Be Back Before Midnight at the Huron Country Playhouse, an amazingly successful play. As I said, it's been performed all over the world. But before we get to the podcast, I just want to say thank you so much. I got some more emails. I received some more emails about the last podcast, which was with Bethany Kovarik. Bethany is the ensemble swing at Stratford Festival's production of Crazy for You. Another, if you haven't seen that show and you like Gershwin, even if you don't like Gershwin, go see it. Crazy for You at the Stratford Festival. So Bethany, as the ensemble swing, spends most of her time backstage being ready to go on if one of the ensembles can't make it or trips and falls or breaks a leg, something horrible like that. But I got a very funny email. I have to tell this. I'm not going to read it to you because it's kind of long, but I got a very funny email from someone named Jenny in Toronto. And Bethany is a swing. That's her title. That's her position, sort of like an understudy, but they call it swing. And Jenny wrote that she lives in Toronto, and she was hooking up with an old person on Facebook, and they were both sort of single. So there was that sort of sexual tension. She hadn't seen this person since high school. And the word swing came up, and Jill, Jenny. Jenny had just read this article on Toronto Life magazine about the amount of swingers clubs, so clubs that are for swingers, people who want to get together and, you know, swing in the sexual way, in strip malls in and around Toronto. So they're not hidden, or they're not, you already expect them, they're in strip malls. So you might get a sports store, a variety store, and a swingers club in a strip mall. So she had this going on in her mind when her friend, or her old friend from high school, is on Facebook and actually texts, and they're talking about random things. And somehow the word swing came up. Oh, do you like to swing? And Jenny, the person that wrote the email to me, said, oh, I right away thought the person was thinking about swinging in the let's change our partners instead of let's go round and round. And she replied, I guess she replied something neutral, I guess, if you're into that. And then the person said something else. And then Jenny said, well, how long have you been into swinging? And the person said, oh, a couple of years. And then Jenny's still kind of like shocked this person is revealing this over Facebook, you know. And then Jenny wrote, how did you get into it in the first place? Which I think, you know, as a journalist, great question. And the person replies, my dad was into it, and that's how I got into it. So at this point, Jenny's like completely floored that this, now she's talking to a weirdo, which you get on Facebook sometimes too. Anyway, it turns out the person wasn't talking about swinging in the sexual way. She was talking about swing dancing, and Jenny didn't know that because she had just read the article in Toronto Life. Anyway, thanks so much for sharing that crazy story. Now I got some more emails from the podcast with Jim Mizon from the Shaw Festival. If you haven't listened to that one, Jim's been there for 30 years, one of Canada's most celebrated and undervalued actors, I would say. Jim Mizon, just a solid working, hardworking man at the Shaw Festival. Now today, another hardworking man, originally from the UK, originally from the United Kingdom, came to Canada for all things to complete his master's degree in geography at Western University here in London, Ontario. That's where I'm based. I'm in my suburban basement spare room right now in London. I teach at Western, so that was kind of nice to hear that that Peter actually went to Western and had a great experience there. But most of his great experiences were outside of the class. He met his wife there. He was directing a show at the Alt House Theatre and met his wife, so that was wonderful. And he ended up going from, you know, doing his MA to writing an amazingly successful play at the Grand Theatre in London, Ontario. It was a hugely successful play. And it held box office records at the Grand Theatre. It was about the Donnellys, you know, the Black Donnellys, James Rainey went out and did a drama about it, but Peter did it many years ago as a musical. And I think the box office record might have been broken, though, just recently this winter by Shrek. Was it Shrek? No. What's it called? The Grand Theater did a play this Christmas time. It was a big hit. Elf, right, the Jon Favreau movie that was adapted by Bob Martin, who did The Drowsy Chaperone. Anyway, Bob Martin adapted it. So a great, another Ontario playwright. Yay, Bob Martin. That did amazing numbers for the Grand Theater. Anyway, the Grand Theater, we do talk about London in the podcast. Don't forget, if you hear us talk about London, we're talking about London, Ontario, home of the Grand Theater, which kicked off in 1901. That place has been around forever, and it's just an amazing history there. And it was a big part of launching Peter's success, and lots of other people, too. So before I get into the podcast, I'll just tell you a bit about his bio. Peter, his plays have been produced. I'm reading now. Can you tell? His plays have been produced in 29 countries, 48 of the 50 U.S. states, and every single province in Canada. Peter was nominated for the 2000 Humanitas Prize for screenwriting and was a semifinalist for the 2006 and 2007 Eugene O'Neill Awards. So amazing kudos, amazing biography and history and playwriting, and just a super generous guy. He was very open about how working on his academic work helped him to do research for the plays that he wrote and had success with in the early days. Talks a little bit about the dark times, but also talks about the money that he made from playwrights. And I never felt comfortable enough to ask someone as directly as I talked to Peter about it. And he actually shares some of the income he's made from his plays. So really interesting podcast. Hope you enjoy it. Before we get to it, I have to, as always, say thank you so much to Karen Hartwick at Stratford Tea Leaves. If you're in or near Stratford, make sure you drop by to Stratford Tea Leaves or take a look at them online, stratfordtealeaves.com. But if you're in the area, book a tea tasting or just drop by to experience the world's best, freshest, and most exotic loose leaf teas with Karen Hartwick, Canada's tea sommelier. She has a little paper. She is a tea sommelier, an amazingly powerful distinction. Way fewer tea sommeliers than wine sommeliers. Same kind of thing. Anyway, Karen Hartwick. Give her a call. You can call her. The number's on the website. She'll talk to you about tea. All right, that's it. Let's listen to Peter Colley talking about his background. He was in town because his production, I'll Be Back Before Midnight, his play, I'll Be Back Before Midnight, is being performed at the Huron County Playhouse right now, Huron Country Playhouse right now. By the way, he did tell me, it's sort of crazy, he does travel sometimes to where his plays are being produced, and he has been actually barred from entering the theaters where his plays are being produced. So we talk about that too. Hope you enjoy. Here it comes.
Actually, I was born in England.
Okay.
In a little sea town called Scarborough,
uh-huh,
which is up on the northeast coast. And I left there when I was 6 weeks old.
Oh, okay.
No, we had a summer house there. And my father was stationed in Germany with the Royal Air Force. I think he'd been part of the Berlin airlift because we were Royal Air Force Wunstorf, which was the main airlift airfield for the British sector. So as soon as my mother and my twin brother and I were stable, we were whisked over to Germany, where we lived for the next 4.5 years.
Hmm.
So I grew up sort of in Germany for a while, and I learned German because we lived out in the community.
Okay.
And
yeah, so you weren't sort of an expat little. You were with the Germans.
We were with the German community. We were in this huge house, which my elder brother told me had been expropriated from a former Nazi general after the war, and the RAF just took these things.
Oh, and there you go.
And in we were.
And was your father still in the services at that time?
Yes.
Ah, that's why you were there.
He was a career man. He joined up as a boy apprentice at 15 and served in the Far East on flying boats.
Oh, my goodness.
And then during the war years, he and my mother and my elder brother were trapped on the island of Malta during the Great Siege of Malta.
Wow.
3,000 air raids.
Yeah.
And had a, you know, and my mom and brother finally had a hair-raising escape from that island, which should never have happened. But
sure,
if they hadn't managed to escape, then I would not
be
alive.
Be
I was a post-war boomer.
Yeah. So Germany for 4 years, and then, so where is...
Then back to England. Okay. We were stationed in the north at an air base there, and then we were stationed again in the south of England.
Mm-hmm.
Another air base, Bomber Command. And it was there that I spent kind of my formative years, because from the age of about 5 and a half to the age of 10, I grew up just outside London, which turned out to be very fortuitous because in the entertainment business, you know, my life really changed, and I can, it happened in one night, as it does.
So you remember? You remember
vividly, vividly. Okay. I can see everything like it was yesterday. My mother had taken us to see a panto, a classic British panto, at the London Palladium.
Wow.
Starring Norman Wisdom. Now, we saw a few of them, and I can't remember if the first one I saw was Aladdin or whether it was Dick Whittington and his cat or one of the other classics. But I just remember being so blown away by the experience.
At age 10?
Oh, no, I was younger.
Oh,
I was
younger.
Seven.
Okay.
Six or seven.
Wow.
Yeah, probably that, seven.
I took my little guy to see the Drayton Festival pantomime this winter for his first time. And he was at the back. We were in like the third to the last end of the row in the back of the theater. And he was screaming. He was like right on stage with those actors.
Yes, yes, yes. Shouting, look behind the rock, the villain's there.
Exactly.
Don't tell Aladdin. Don't sell the lamp.
And I was amazed at how he remembered, like, weeks afterwards, he got the jokes and he would actually integrate them into some of the conversations. I was fascinated by that. It's amazing that the pantomime doesn't set more of a tradition here in North America.
I hope it's becoming that way. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I wintered down in Los Angeles and now they have a tradition of a pantomime at the Pasadena Playhouse, which is the State Theater of California. And I went to see it this year. And I took my wife, because I had talked to her all my life about my... You know,
and she'd never seen one?
She'd never seen a panto. And so we went to see it, and she was just... Her eyes were just as wide. She was shouting at
the exactly.
Just as long
time.
With the kids. And what's so important about the panto is it raises the next generation of theatergoers and actors and writers and directors. Yeah. And in England, it's almost, you know, like child endangerment not to take your child to the panto.
Yeah.
You know, every mother who has a child between the age of 5 and 10 or 11 until they turn into that teenage-y thing, you have to take your kid to the panto.
So you do that, and then when did in school were you able to sort of perform in school, or when did you start actually?
Well, almost immediately. I mean, this was obviously in December because that's when the pantos go on. And immediately my mind started to sort of turn to things about how I could do something like that. And luckily, my mother gave me a book called, I think it's 100 Things to Do on a Rainy Day.
Ha, that's great.
You know, which is, in England, there's a lot of rainy days to keep your children occupied. And in it was how to construct a little, I think it was a Balinese shadow theater.
Oh, how beautiful. Yeah.
And you made the little frame out of cardboard and you put a screen up of, you know, like wax paper.
Sure. Yeah.
And a little light bulb behind it. And you cut out your characters, and they were silhouette characters, and you had these little long wooden skewers.
Yeah, to move them, like to the marionettes, back. But from the bottom. Yeah.
Right, and you can move, you know, arms and whatever. And also, I'd seen the Punch and Judy shows at our little summer house in Scarborough, because every summer, do you know what a Punch and Judy show is?
Is it a puppet show, but a little bit violent?
It's like, very violent.
Sort of like Comedia with puppets?
Yes, you have it exactly.
Okay.
Oh, my God. I mean, the children who have been damaged by
that.
But it's a wonderful little puppet show.
Right.
And they have these little kind of canvas covered wood frame little marionette theaters.
It's very portable.
And they just
come
right on the beach.
Yeah.
And then all the children, they come and they watch Mr. Punch, and there's some, I forget who it is, Mr. Punch keeps trying to feed the baby to an alligator or something.
Right.
He's like, ooh.
Yeah, so there's the stock characters and that sort
of
thing.
Yes, you're right about it being straight out Punchinella, you know, Comedia. So I'd seen that already. So already I was very well versed in certain types of puppet, and now I'd seen the panto.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'm going to have to make up a story. And I built the little theater, and I cut out my characters, and I created some story which has been lost to history.
Yeah.
But on our airbase, I invited all the children. Luckily, we lived in a fairly... In those days, we were living on base. We had offices, married quarters, a bunch of classic little houses in a little 50s development. And I put posters up around people's lawns, you know, saying, big show tonight, my house, you know. And I think I promised cookies as well, which
that always
ensured a full house. And it was packed. My living room was absolutely packed. And I did the show, and people liked it. And I thought, well, this is a hell of a way to make a living.
And here you are now.
That's it. 7 years old. I was already, you know, the entrepreneur, I guess.
But people, you know, I was teaching film in the Middle East a couple of years ago, and this student took my film class, and he graduated. And he's like, now what do I do? And I said, well, make films. Like, you've never had, I mean, at least you were using technology, the puppets and the marionettes, you know, you can make that. These days, you have, students have access to all that gear, and it's just, you know, do what you love and the money will come. I mean, I don't know if I buy that or not, but it's probably your case. It's exactly sort of what happened. You continue to perform and to conceive and produce.
That's right. I often look back and think, well, did I just get really, really lucky?
Right.
Because I just like fell in a pot of honey, I felt like, because I never studied theater and I never studied writing. You know, my father being a military
man.
Yeah,
we're going to get there eventually. So,
he said, get a real degree.
Of course.
Don't mess about with this silly writing thing of yours.
And so you did in the UK, is that correct?
Yes, I actually got a degree from Sheffield University for geography, geology, and economics.
Wow, that's
And that's when I came to Weston and I did, you know, studied for my master's there with the same subject.
So did you leave Sheffield and then go right to Western?
Yes.
And what made you pick Western in Canada?
My professor in England had told me that it was a suburb of Toronto. This is a geography professor.
Yeah, that's like, 2 hours away for the people that know. And back then, the roads probably weren't as good as they are. Not that they're very good now either, actually, but yeah, it's a drive.
I really was just doing it so that I could look at the theater scene, and eventually, you know, when I'd finished my academic work, I could springboard off into the Toronto theater scene. So imagine my surprise when I arrive in Canada and I get on a bus, and it's like 2 hours.
The suburb of Toronto.
When is this going to
start? So back in England, you graduated, so your father was probably happy that you graduated?
He was, from that moment on, I could do anything I wanted.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah. I mean, that's part of, I love talking to people here about their fathers, because I am a father. My little guy's 7, but it's always hard for me to figure out what it's, to be a father is a hard thing. So you made your dad happy, and did you do theater while you were doing the degree, or just sort of just?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
We had a theater group.
Right.
Now, British universities in those days they were very academic institutions. They really didn't have a theater program or a playwriting program. They weren't practical.
Right, it was extracurricular.
The way things are here. We just had a theater group.
And I'm fascinated by the fact that in England, then you conceived, okay, I want to go to a university that has the same sort of geography, but I also want to go to an area where there's theater. So you actually researched the Toronto theater scene back in England? Or
as much as one could.
Yeah.
Before the internet, I knew it was a big city, and I thought, well, there's going to be theater there for sure.
Wow.
Instead, I arrived in London, Ontario, which was a hell of a long way from London, from Toronto. But by magic, there was a beautiful Grand Theater.
It's called the Grand Theater.
There.
Yeah, historic building.
And as soon as I saw that, I thought, you know, I'm home.
Wow, yeah.
Theater people have this thing that when you can be in a foreign country, you know, I've seen my shows in Shanghai, in Mandarin, I've seen them in Germany, and I've seen them in Italy, you know. And yeah, as soon as you walk into a theater, it's a little village where theater people, we're all in
sure.
it together.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, I just recently, I think about a year or so ago, when I was in China for my show in Shanghai, I did a side trip to Hong Kong, just for fun.
That's where I saw my first panto, was in Hong Kong, actually.
Oh, of course, because of
the British
tradition.
British rule, yeah.
Well, my wife and I wanted to go swimming in the South China Sea. We thought this would be cool. So we took an insane bus ride, double-decker bus careening through these mountains. We came down to a little village called Shek O, I think it was.
Not the beach. I did one of those double-decker buses on these crazy to the beach. I don't remember the name of the beach, but I did that. It might have been. Was it on Central or was it on? It was on the island of Hong Kong or over on the other side?
It was on the island.
Yeah, that's probably the same beach I went to.
Right. It's quite famous.
Yeah, yeah. That must be the beauty. And all of a sudden you go around one of these corners and then the beach reveals itself.
Yes, that's it. That's it. I'm sure it was the same one.
Yeah, I did that, yeah.
And we were just walking through the little village and I noticed a huge bamboo theater had been erected in the middle of the village square.
That's pretty cool.
And we thought, well, this is interesting. We heard this strange sort of Chinese music and stuff. And we peered in through the bamboo slats. And there was it was Cantonese style opera, traditional. And they were rehearsing and we were staring. And this fellow came over to us who was the producer. And he said, oh, are you interested in theater? And I said, well, we've just come from Shanghai doing a show. And he said, well, this is our last night. They sort of tour the shows around of our season. And we're rehearsing right now. So if you'd like, you can just hang around with the company and stay and see the show in the evening.
That's pretty cool. Huh?
And we did, and it was so funny because the actors, even though they were traditional, you know, Cantonese opera, and it looked very much like pantomime.
Hmm.
When they goofed off in rehearsal, they were like every other actor I've ever seen anywhere in the world. Yeah. It was a truly magical experience. I felt like I'd almost returned to my roots because of the panto-ish.
Yeah, no matter where you are, the theater will always be your home.
And they welcome you.
Yeah, that's absolutely. Well, you welcome me to come and talk to you on this day that the show is actually going to be up. So you come to London, you do the Western thing, and then did you finish, or how did that work out? So you're doing your master's degree, and then the Grand Theater is probably a distraction.
Yeah, so the Grand was very distracting, but I was doing a lot of shows at Western.
Okay.
Yeah. I played Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady at the Talbot Theater.
Yeah.
And I directed What a Lovely War at the, was it Alt House Theater?
Yeah, that makes sense, Alt House. Yeah.
And, of course, that's where I met my wife in that show. That was my first year at Weston. Another reason to stay.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, The Lark. I played, I forget what it, the Duke of somebody.
So when did you have time to finish your degree?
That was the problem.
Okay. Just super busy with the
super,
theater.
Super, super busy. Yeah. And I even had, I think they had a drama program there, and I had professors coming up to me and saying, why don't we ever see you in class? You're doing all these these lead roles and everything. And I go, I'm actually in the...
That's interesting. And how are you communicating with your father? Because I would imagine that part of that was still for your father at that point.
Oh, it was. It was. You're always trying to impress.
Yeah.
But luckily, the great thing about the entertainment business is even if you're a long, long way away, now you can't afford long-distance calls back. This was back in the 70s.
Yeah.
You have newspaper clippings.
Oh, wow.
So whatever I got a review in the paper, you know, and when you're in the theater, you get a lot of attention. I would package these up. And
I love that.
Send them home to my parents to show that I wasn't the bum they
but
thought
did,
I was.
Is he not going to send me your grades? I wanted, but he didn't care at that point.
He didn't care. His great goal in life, and it was a singular obsession of his, was for one of his children to get an honors degree from a really good British university.
Sure.
And my elder brother had, you know, a little too much wine, women, and song, and he flamed out.
Oh, boy.
And my twin brother was the golden boy. I was like the retarded one in the family. You know, I couldn't add up my dot score, and I was dyslexic, it turned out.
Okay.
We didn't use that term in those days.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
They called it stupidity.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But perseverant to succeed academically that far despite that, and it probably wasn't recognized, you know.
No, it certainly wasn't. But I needed, my mathematical skills were extremely difficult to get, but I had to get them in order to get entrance to a good university. So, you know, by luck and good teachers, I managed to scrape enough at that level, and my other things were good grades.
Yeah. You must have been a super busy kid.
Oh, I was super busy because at school, not only did I did a Guildford and Sullivan operas every year, I did Shakespeare plays with the drama club. I was also captain of basketball, captain of rugby, captain of cricket,
oh my gosh,
and track and field captain.
Right, right.
And we also county captain of basketball. And I went on to captain Sheffield University of basketball. So I was always caught between the sporting world and the world.
Yeah, that's an interesting duality that I don't think we see very much, because often the theater people end up being, in high school, there's those lines. You're the theater person, or you're at least in the world that I grew up in, the theater people and the athletes didn't really get along.
Oh, it was. And it was a bit of a stigma, too, because I was really known as an athlete more than a theater person. And so the little in crowd for the theater had a trouble accepting me.
Huh.
And I always remember that being kind of like, no, I'm one of you. You know, I've been doing this since I was a kid. My grandfather was a theater impresario.
Okay.
He owned the Pontefract Playhouse, which has been doing shows since the 1770s.
So on your father's side or your mom?
That was my mother's side.
Okay.
I think I got all my theater stuff from mother's
your mom,
side.
Yeah.
She loved the theater. And in fact, she went to Leeds Art College. And what was so curious is her graduating picture was a pastiche on British pantomime.
Hmm.
Isn't that curious?
Yeah, yeah.
And her father, of course, owned various theaters, but the Pontefract Playhouse was our home theater. And I always grew up with that. I never really lived in Pontefract, but because we were military brats. Yeah. But from time to time, we would breeze through. And
it felt like home because it was your grandfather's
place. Yeah. I mean, he had turned it into kind of a half movie, half kind of vaudeville place.
Yeah.
And as children, we grew up with Saturday matinees.
Right.
I'm not sure if
you... Yeah, the movie, you mean,
the
right?
movies.
Yeah,
we would all go to the movie house and they would have these these Buck Rogers-y kind of thing,
a comedy or two,
Tom and Jerry. Yeah. But between the acts, between the reels, they would have live acts.
Wow. I don't know if that's more of a British tradition. I don't remember that from – I haven't heard of that in North America. But I get that given the British – the tradition with the stage and everything. So that's
– We had magicians. We had dog acts. We had, you know, all sorts of corny stuff.
And so we're talking like the – what period of time here?
This would be the 60s.
So actually. Older guys who probably didn't have anywhere else to work.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly.
Wow, what
now
a trip.
I do have some great old postcards from the very early days of his theater because he bought that theater – in 1916, I think.
Hmm.
He actually bought a theater in 1913 and then went off to war. It was a different theater for 4 years. But I think it was still running while he was in the trenches. But I have some pictures from entertainers sending postcards to him saying, "We are currently at liberty."
Oh, to accept him.
Yeah, there's a beautiful one. It was an acrobatic act. It was four guys. They're called the Four Londons. And they're, you know, those fantastic kind of poses with the funny pants they have on and the tights.
Yeah.
And they're all posed like, you know, showing their muscles off and saying, dear manager Firth, because Firth was my mother's side, distantly related to Colin Firth, perhaps. And saying, we're currently at liberty, you know, should you require our services? And that was from like 1920.
Amazing. How cool is that?
And I have a poster at home from the theater from 1822, and I have a script that they found, an old manuscript they found in the ruins when they, unfortunately, they tore it down, from 1777.
A script?
Mm-hmm.
So handwritten?
No, it's actually printed.
Printed.
Okay. And the S's are like F's and the whole thing.
That's amazing. So you were basically destined. Did you ever feel that pressure? Did you ever feel that you were destined? Or
I never felt any pressure. I felt a lot of pressure not to do it.
Sure, from the tradition of
right,
the
because we'd been disinherited from that side of the family.
Oh,
because
well, for whatever
they were well off, and my father had been a coal miner's
son. Hardworking guy, yeah.
And they were in the same town, but the north end of the town was where all the coal mines were.
Uh-huh.
And the south end of the town was where all the owners of the coal mines, rich people lived.
Sure.
And my mother was from the rich side of the town, and my father was from the poor side of the town, and they eloped. They had to run away to Malta to marry.
That's why they ended up in Malta.
Right. He'd been posted there.
Sure.
And he said, listen, if you come to Malta, I'll marry you the day you arrive. And
she did.
She did. She snuck away from her family. And
wow. So then when they came back, they had to live in the north side then?
Well, when he was in the forces, so...
Right. Oh, so they were away.
We always had air bases where we lived.
Yeah.
We just went from... The only thing that was a constant was our little summer house.
And was it tough for your mom, though? Did she have to or was it just the tension in the house around the classes? Or did your mother actually have to disown that side of the family a bit?
Yeah, well, my mother was a very sweet, easygoing kind of person. And she was a romantic. She believed in love.
Sure.
So we saw the rich side of the family. We actually saw the rich side of the family far more than the poor side.
Hmm.
My father was so ashamed of his poor ancestry that I only recall seeing them once in my whole life.
Wow.
When I was about 12. And we were in... By then, we'd gone to the Royal Grammar School. We'd got a scholarship to go to the Royal Grammar School just outside London. And my father dressed us up in our school uniforms with a badge and the cap.
Yeah.
And spruced us up and make sure we looked, you know, very upper class. And he took us to see the grandparents. And I felt like I'd walked into a Bronte novel.
Oh, my goodness.
On the moors, and they were cooking with coal on a big old hob.
Sure,
thing.
Yeah.
They were very nice people, but they were like aliens from another planet to me.
That must have been a really interesting moment for your father.
Yeah. I often wondered why he didn't take us more often, but I think I know. He wanted to prepare us.
Sure.
You know, because he was now an officer and a gentleman.
Yeah.
And he'd lost his working class accent. And we lived among people with good educations.
Yeah.
Hence his obsession with...
Yeah, a good education.
Yes.
That's a great story. So there you are in London, and then so you hook up with the folks at the Grand Theatre, I'm guessing, because I read that one of the plays you did at the Grand, the Donnellys, which is the great Canadian story of the Donnelly family, right not too far from where we are now, the play was commissioned by the dramaturge there in... I don't know.
He was the artistic director.
The artistic director, I'm sorry. What was the year? I don't know the year of that.
Oh, boy, that would have been 74,
so
75?
It was, the drama broke the theatre's 70-year-old box office record, selling 99.69% of capacity. And Jamie Portman, who's still around writing reviews, and he's in my post his reviews on Stratford Festival Reviews. He wrote that Donnelly's is a stunning box office success, intelligent entertainment, nimble yet perceptive, rich in atmosphere, and compelling in incident. I love that. This is important theater. So that was a huge... Was that your big first success?
My first show. I had done a small show in England just after I left Sheffield. I managed to sell a little small play, sort of a full length, but, you know, a short one.
Right.
Maybe
no intermission sort of.
Right. Yeah. 70-minute, 75-minute thing. And it got accepted by a small professional company or semi-professional. It was sort of an offshoot of the drama club from the university. And they said, we're going to do your show. So I had that, and I got a nice review from an important newspaper saying, promising.
Because you're young.
And the audience seemed to like it, so I thought a promising young voice or something. So I took that review. I just had the one good review, the only review there was, and I had shown it to Heiner Piller and pitched him a few stories that I thought would make good good shows. And I had done a small show for him at the little mini stage,
ADC London.
I'd already done one.
Ontario, just so no one's confused. Downstairs in the theater, there's a small, like a black box.
Right, well, this was
box.
Actually before,
oh, okay, before the
McManus. It was a little one. It was about half a mile away.
Oh,
it was a little 80-seat black box thing.
Nice.
And it was maybe 40 seats. I'm dyslexic, sorry.
There you go.
And so he'd seen a little bit of my writing, and I had this review from England, and I pitched him various ideas for a show for the mini stage. I had no dream of going to the main stage. That was...
Yeah, well, you're young.
They didn't do brand new shows on the main stage, for one thing. I was pitching something for the mini stage. And he kept coming back to things saying, well, that's interesting, but have you ever thought of doing this Donnelly story?
Hmm.
And I went, geez, that's all I've heard since I've been here. Donnelly this, Donnelly that. Isn't it a little overdone? And he said, well, it's never been done on the stage here. So I said, okay, you know, I'll give it a try. So I knocked out about 20 pages, and then I asked him, I said, do you mind if I make it into a musical?
And there's a lot of research in this process, because you're actually going into archives, or how did you, because there's a whole family story there of them coming from Ireland and killing each other.
So. I had to do a lot. And there were books, of course, that had been written, but I wanted to go to the source. I didn't want to steal, you know, books. So I went to the source, I went to the library, and they had the records.
In the actual town? Oh, the town where the massacre happened?
Actually, London.
Oh, okay.
Oh, London. You can't get anything out of Lucan in those days.
it was the shame of the city.
Well, they were very hostile to people talking about
Donnelly's. The Donnellys.
Really hostile.
So it's a great process that you've learned, so you're going to go through all the research, which you probably picked up that skill in academia.
Absolutely.
And the discipline.
You knew where to go. But even those days, there was this big stigma hanging over the Donnelly legend. It was people would say, don't go there. It's all bad luck. There's a curse.
Wow.
You know, a sandbag's going to drop on your head.
Oh, my gosh.
And there's a lot of hostility because the town of Lucan is made up of the descendants of the people who did the killing.
Yeah.
Right? The murderers.
The survivors.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's no Donnellys left.
They're all dead.
The hell out of town. You know, the few that were left.
Yeah.
And so I remember one time I went up to Lucan. I wanted to find the graveyard or the gravestone. So I stopped at a gas station just outside Lucan. And said, can you direct me to the, you know, in the old Donnelly farmhouse? And he said, oh, yeah, it's easy. So you go down this road. You just keep going until you see, like, a church with the white steeple on it or something like that. I said, great, thank you. Well, half an hour later, I'm driving, and I realize I've been given a bone steer.
The guy just doesn't want to have anything to do with it.
They another stupid tourist coming to, you know, dig up our history. So now, very luckily... one of the guys who was in one of the shows at Weston with me, was in My Fair Lady with me, had been born in Lucan.
Oh.
Mike Culbert, wonderful, wonderful guy, became my best friend. And he said, I'll show you around. I know all this stuff. And I said, you're not worried about the curse? He said, the curse. So he showed me, and he was a great help. And then two or three years later, he dropped dead from a brain aneurysm.
Oh, wow.
So... I still feel guilty. In fact, on Saturday when I was down in London, I had emailed Jeff Culbert, his younger brother, his little kid brother, who's a spitting image of Mike, you know, so we could meet. So, and he's sort of become a pal of mine because you know, he took up the reins from poor Mike, who I'm still missed to this day.
So you get the work together and get it on stage and it's a hit and you're just a young kid.
Right. I was like 23, I think.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh, well, it's always going to be like this. Of course, it wasn't. Life, you know, can start out, you know, with a huge hit. And then I had a couple of other hits. We did the War Show next.
In London still?
In London, so in on London. The Grand. That was premiered at the Grand the following year. And that's been done. It was just done a few months ago.
Wow. You so know, it's alive.
Theater Mississauga, the Meadowvale Theater. So that's been popular ever since. But then I went into a bit of a decline because after the Heine left the Grand, of course, a whole new regime.
Right, of course,
comes
in. Yeah. And they want to bring in their people.
Yeah,
and,
I was part of the old, old regime.
Yeah, I've been there.
So I was kind of stuck on the outside looking in.
And really not an employee. You don't have a formal job at that point. You're a writer.
That's right.
You're not connected to the Grand. It's just the grace is, oh, this is a good script. Let's do it. Let's not do it.
Right.
So the structure changes. You're basically not necessarily part of the group anymore.
Right. And originally, for about 3 years, I was actually on salary because
I
was acting there too, and I think I directed some stuff. But we were all part of a company.
Right.
They had a wonderful resident company of actors. Mm. And those were the days.
Yeah, exactly.
We had a young company, which is why when, I mean, to go back to the Donalds, I was writing it for the mini theater.
Right. Yeah.
And Heine kept saying, why are you using so small number of people? And I said, well, the mini stage is only like 25 feet across or 20 feet across. And he said, what? I'm not talking about the mini theater. I'm talking about the Grand. He says,
that's great.
This theater opened with Ben-Hur with real horses.
That's hilarious. I didn't know that.
Yeah. That was its premiere in 1906, I think. And he says, no, we've got lots of room. And he says, we've got a resident company of like almost 20 actors. We've got a young company of 10 actors. He said, we can use them all.
Let's do it. Wow. So I'm curious in that point. So there's people in your shoes today. They're young actors in London who have had success, not necessarily at the Grand, but in other places in London, and then even toured with shows. And then, but you hit a wall in London because there's only so much you can do. Is that what happened to you eventually?
Absolutely. Or? Yes.
Just, you know,
but luckily, you know, I was still an actor, not a very good one, but I was still acting. And I got offered, which was a real letdown. I was ready to take any job, but it was touring with a puppet show.
Uh-huh.
It was The Little Prince.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I was to play the only human in the show.
Oh, wow.
I was the narrator pilot.
Sure. Yeah.
And I was surrounded by wonderful puppetry by Vera Hrdlicka, who I think is Czech, Czech designer. So I said, okay. So I'm on the road and I end up in Blythe doing an afternoon show.
Smaller town. London is a small town to Toronto. Blythe is a small town to London.
And they had just started a summer theater there. And I think it was Kate Trotter was working there, and she came out with like this big bowl of strawberries, and we sat on the lawn there.
It literally is the Blythe Festival, just for the folks. It's literally in the middle of farmland. There's a very small little village, and there's this old, it's in a church now. I don't know if it was in the church back then, the theater there. And there's
right.
Maybe there's a barn.
It was a church. I think it was an old town hall.
Yeah,
too.
I'm a town hall. That's right. So just when you say strawberries, they were probably picked like 20 minutes ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and Kate was a pretty girl, and she just sat next to me. She says, oh, by the way, James Roy, who was the artistic director there, asked me to ask you if you'd be interested in writing a show for us. He says, I know this is a very small theater and we can't offer big commissions or anything, but what do you think? And I said, sure.
Yes.
I wasn't doing much else, you know.
Right.
So that winter, I wrote a piece called The Huron Tiger, which is about the development of the the Canada Company that was developing the Queensbush, which was set in the 1830s. And how this one company kind of like dominated everything, was a bit crooked, very crooked.
Sure.
And about the one guy, a fellow called Tiger Dunlop, who was a character who fought against the monopoly power of the Canada Company.
Right.
It was a great story. He was a great character. And so that was the first show we did. And it was very well received. But it was a costume drama, and there was seven or eight characters in it. And I sent it out a lot to theaters around Canada.
Trying to get it published. Well, because you have at that point you have a reputation as well in terms of publishing.
A little bit.
A little bit,
yes.
Yeah. So you're actually yourself sending it to theaters. You're not working through an agent.
No. I've never been, you know, I've had an agent from time to time, but it's never really helped that much.
I get
much.
You. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I've always thought, if I'm going to do it,
I'll just send it out.
I'll send it. There's not that many theaters in Canada.
Sure.
And I like to have the personal contact.
Absolutely,
And I showed them. We got some nice reviews. I think we even got a Globe and Mail review, which was really nice, and all the local reviews were good. But the response I got was that, well, it's a costume drama. It's a historical drama. Mm. We're sort of moving away from that. It's got too many characters.
Yeah.
And so I didn't get to resell it, which was the first time that had happened. I was like, oh, dear. So I got that was the winter of my discontent, I call it. I was a little angry and a little bitter about...
In Blythe, in the small town, did you go back to the...
I was living in London all the time.
Okay, so you're in London, you're staying in a...
But I was in a little apartment, and I wasn't making a lot of money.
Yeah, after that huge success.
After the... Yes, exactly. It was a come down. And then I thought, well, all right. So these are the rules. You want a small character play. You want a modern play. I thought, I'm going to hit you with every trick I've ever learned in the book. I'm going to have something that's thrilling, that's funny.
And did you have to take a job at this point, or were you okay financially?
I was okay.
You were okay.
I never took... I had two brief stints just to pay the rent.
Right.
I think for 2 or 3 weeks, I tried driving a tow truck.
Okay.
That didn't work out. And I briefly, later on in the 70s, I worked as a bartender in a disco.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, the disco.
That was like a 3-month thing. Right. But apart from that, I've never had proper employment.
So at this point, but that might have driven you in the winter of your discontent to realize, you know.
This is a moneymaker.
Yeah.
So I just threw everything I knew at it. It was going to be fun. It was going to be theatrical. It was going to be, you know, small cast. And that was I'll Be Back Before Midnight.
I'll Be Back Before Midnight, which is playing right now at the Drayton Theater Festival.
Right.
Yeah.
And then when we premiered that at Blythe, it was like, it just went ballistic.
It's something for people that are interested in writing and thinking about. So you played, you opened at a small theater in a small town with a good reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And really, how did it spread? How did the success?
It just spread like wildfire. It was just like the Bush Telegraph somehow. I mean, Blythe wasn't really the Blythe we know today then.
So
this was in the early days.
Gotcha. So your success probably helped build the reputation that it has
now.
Oh,
I'm sure it was helpful because there were a number of other shows they had that they were always doing good work.
Right.
But the next thing I know is I'm, you know, getting calls from all these other theaters saying, you know, we heard that was one honking good comedy thriller and that the audience was just like riveted to their seats. Which I thought, well, that's good.
And the theater's asking you to write or just to purchase the rights?
They just want the rights to do it.
Yeah. And how, forgive me because I don't know enough about that side of things, but I think it's an interesting thing. How lucrative can that be in a market like Canada?
Oh, it's actually, Canada's a good market.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, I just got a check from England for Midnight, which was playing there for 8 weeks back in October, just outside London. And, you know, it's like, let me see, it was £1, so converted, it came to about $7,000 or $8,000.
Right.
Oh, actually, Canadian, so it'll be about $8,000 or $9,000 for a long 8-week run. Well, in Canada, you probably, for an 8-week run in a theater that size, you could make almost not quite double that.
Wow.
Because you get a high percentage of the box office in Canada.
Okay.
America's moving that way. America's now up to like 8% at the box office for a regional theater. So every night, the playwright gets 8% of the ticket.
Hmm.
And you can make a living.
But have.
Yeah. The one thing I do advise, you know, anyone who wants to get into such a precarious business.
It is very precarious. Yeah.
Is because the money comes and goes, make sure that you know how to live cheaply.
Right. Oh, yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
You know, yeah. I've always been a person...
Live below your means.
Who lived below my means, and I saved money.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I drive the car I have done in the States. It's a wonderful... 1976.
Like a Mercedes?
It's a Mercedes.
Exactly, because it'll last. It's an investment.
There's no rust down there.
I just guessed because you said 76. What car is going to last from 1976 to now?
But it's the same car. I mean, I bought it for cash when it was about 10 years old. And people around me, all my friends, they've got new cars and new cars. They got leases and leases.
Yeah, lots of dough.
You know, this thing chugs along.
It works fine.
I haven't taken it to the garage for 3 years now.
That's great.
And so, you know, the house is now paid off.
Yeah.
So you learn, you know, and I know how to fix all my own plumbing.
Oh, man. We just bought a house a while ago, my wife and I had no idea. Like, this best thing I could do with my time now is learn how to fix plumbing, learn how to do woodwork. Like, seriously, I would save so much money. Electricity, I don't want to touch. But that's a trades guy. All of a sudden, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of dollars
for
nothing.
Absolutely. I've probably saved us at least $100,000 over the years because I know how to fix stuff.
That's amazing. Doing it on your own.
Yeah. Because my dad was an engineer. I learned a few things from
him. That's amazing. That's great. See, I didn't have that growing up. My father was not. So we had no power tools, nothing. So, you know, I'm embarrassed that I can't. I try, and I so far I haven't done any serious damage to anything. But I often have to recruit people who know more. But that's a great point. So when did that occur to you? Did you have a point in your life when you actually overspent and you're like, whoa, I got to slow down when you're thinking you're riding
high? No, I was
always
cheap.
You knew, yeah.
Yes, because I was always frugal because I always saved my money.
Yeah.
My twin brother, of course, was the opposite, and he still owes me £10.
That's funny. So you could see that. You saw the duality between your mother's family and your father's family.
I knew we were disinherited. Or I learned it really from there was one cousin who got all the family money on. He would, for instance, when we were young, he would come home with like a 18-speed brand new bicycle. Yeah. And my father came home and he says, oh, you want a bike? He says, I'll get you the pieces and you build it.
Wow.
So he got me a frame.
Yeah.
And he got me a catalog where you could order the caliper brakes and the gearings system and whatever. And he said, and I think I was 7 or 8 years old. And he said, you know, you build it.
That's great. I got to teach my kid to do that kind of stuff. But I don't know how to do it myself. That's the problem. Yeah. But he doesn't know that.
That's right.
So I might be okay. We'll sort of muddle through it together.
You're so proud as a child of a bike.
I bet.
That works.
Yeah.
That you
built yourself.
That you put together.
That's so cool. So then you're in London. You're kind of doing that. And how was L.A. then? Did you go from London to L.A.?
Oh, no. No. Okay. I went to Toronto.
Toronto, yeah.
Right. Spent quite a few years there. And the only reason we went south was because of the winter, not because of the work.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember one time, my wife's a physiotherapist.
Gotcha.
You know, it's a very in-demand profession. And it was one winter, and we were up in we bought a house in Toronto, and there were no leaves on the trees, and the snow was like going horizontally across the house. And I said, you know, I don't really need to sort of winter here because I do everything by mail.
Right.
I mail the scripts to people. You know, we do it by letters or telephones. And I said, you can work anywhere. And then we can come up here in the summer.
Yeah.
And so she said, that's a great idea. So we headed down there and we winter down there. We do the summers up here. We've got all our families up here. We do the cottage thing.
Perfect.
Do all the summer theaters.
Yeah.
In September, October, I tend to go to England to see my twin brother and the family over there. And got a little house there. So it becomes a little seasonal, and then once it gets cold,
you go
back south.
I assumed because you were in L.A., and I know you've done some work for the movies, that was a draw.
I think it was a dream early on until I realized how little control writers have.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, I'm surprised. I was surprised to hear even at the theater here that you were kind of poking around a little bit. Is that true? You do that?
In what sense?
That you actually watch a rehearsal and might sort of get involved or no?
Oh, yes, totally.
Yeah.
Oh, and I love the theater.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm always surprised that they were surprised. You know, they would say, why you've seen this like 100 times. Like, oh, I know, but you know, I can.
And have you ever had a director say, just because in the film world, exactly, in the movie business, the writer is not on, most of the time,
take him away.
And the director
chains.
Will make changes, the actors will make.
Right.
So have you ever had a theater director here say, I'd rather not, who wasn't familiar with your sort of.
Oh, yeah. I've had a theater director bar the door.
Bar the door.
When they heard I was coming.
Oh, my God.
Only once or twice. And I won't say names. Actually, one of them is no longer with us, so I probably could, but
it's okay.
Yes, I actually got, I just, it was one of those casual things. I often say, oh, look, I'm breezing by your theater this afternoon. I thought I'd just drop in, watch a little rehearsal, have a chat. And I got to the door, and this was a big regional theater. The stage manager was there. You can't come in.
Literally barring you from going
in. He doesn't want you, doesn't think it would be good for the actors to have the playwright around.
Wow.
Usually it means that they're tampering
with the script.
Yeah. They're doing things that they probably shouldn't
be doing. Huh.
But that's very rare.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here, I mean, James, who's doing a lovely job directing, I think was as surprised as anyone else. I said, oh no, I'll drop in. And you know, if I notice something, I'll just say, you know, I think you can tweak that, simply because I've had so much experience.
You've seen it. Yeah. You've seen it.
Yeah.
So here's a question. So here we are, you're doing the show at Drayden, and you talked earlier about, as a writer, selling works, and that's sort of that's basically how you made a living, by selling new plays, correct?
Right.
But we're at a company now that doesn't not really doing any new plays. I don't think they're doing any new plays, at least in this particular theater.
The Drayton?
Yeah, right now.
Oh, I think well, they do. They do the Legends.
The review shows.
Yeah.
The review shows.
But oddly enough, I do chat with Alex about new ideas.
Yeah.
We chatted this time about a concept.
In your experience, and because it's a risk. For any theater, it's going to be a risk if they introduce a new play because the audience that they've brought along with classics or with, you know, something that they're familiar with or something that got a good review or a Tony Award. So now they're saying, here's a play. That's it. Like, there's no Tony Award winning. There's no As Seen on Broadway. It's like, here's a play we really like. Come and buy tickets, hopefully. So do you find that there's less room for new plays, period? Or
I think it's probably harder today.
Yeah.
I'm lucky because I've got a certain track record.
Sure.
And also, I usually get the interest. I usually sell the play on the pitch.
Oh, wow.
I haven't written it yet.
Okay.
And that actually is good for most artistic directors because I think I have a general reputation that I'm a malleable person that I would
work
towards
yeah.
what they want as much as, you know, I'm not going to force some weird thing down their throats.
Yeah.
And for instance, you know, the Lighthouse Festival down in Port Dover.
Okay.
They had done When the Reaper Calls and had a big success with it, and they'd done Midnight and had a big success with it. And over the years, they've done The War Show, they've done The Vaudevillians, they've done The Mark of Cain. These are all plays of mine. And they've all done reasonably well. And so, you know, he said, have you ever thought of writing a new piece for us?
Hmm.
And I said, well, it's funny you should mention that because you are called the Lighthouse Festival. And I've always wanted to write a play set in a lighthouse. And they go,
that's great.
Really? And
yeah.
it would be a comedy thriller like the ones I'm known for. And they go, well, our audience is already like your work, comedy thrillers. And you're saying we're going to put it in a lighthouse and where the Lighthouse Festival is.
Yeah.
Like, I think this might work.
Let's go. Yeah.
So, you know, there's no guarantee that they'll do it.
Right.
I mean, they pay a little commission, and we workshop it, and if it looks
promising,
doable, we're going to be workshopping it in July of this year.
Okay.
Then we go ahead and do it. If they don't do it, you know, I understand completely. You know, if it's not ready.
And then it reverts back to you? If they don't do it, it's yours, you can take it somewhere else?
Sometimes the originating theater takes a little piece for about 5 years.
Yeah.
Not all theaters do that. In the States, they take a huge piece.
Hmm. So you're okay. So to answer my question is, then the theater can sell your name because you've got such a name in that particular genre that the patrons might, oh, I did see I'll Be Back Before Midnight. That was hilarious.
Right.
And I saw Cagney.
When the Reaper Calls or Cagney. You know, they think, oh, well, this guy was, you know, entertains
right.
at the very minimum.
Yeah.
It's kind of like,
the
you
very
know,
minimum.
It's like Norm Foster. I mean, people
sure.
know
he's, the name.
He's
yeah.
Yeah. They're going to have a good time.
Now, how did you guys ever cross paths or work together?
We did. We just crossed paths last year for the first time. I mean, we'd often had shows in the same season at different theaters. But I went to see him up at Orangeville last year. He was performing in one of his plays.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
I've always been a great fan of his. I mean, the quality of his construction. I think he's, you know, the highfalutin types, they sort of say, oh, well, you know, he's sort of Canada's Neil Simon. But I think he's a very good, clever writer. He constructs plays very carefully.
Yeah, so the structure's there.
Yeah, and of course he knows how to write a gag.
Yeah.
Wish I had that talent. So yeah, we met last year and I told him how much I had admired his work over the years.
That's pretty cool. The two Canadian, and that must have been weird because I think I've heard I'll Be Back Before Midnight referred to as the most produced Canadian play.
Apparently, I don't know. It depends on how you define it.
Right.
I think it's been produced in more countries.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
It's been in 29 countries.
Because I think Norm Foster prides himself on being the most
He's the most produced playwright, no doubt about that. I can't compete with him. He has so many more plays. I have very few plays. I take ages to write a play.
Hmm.
Oh, no. Norm is far and away
the
most produced
playwright
in Canada.
But in terms of a single play.
In terms of a single play.
I'll Be Back Before Midnight.
Is the most widely produced. Now, one day Norm will come to me and says, oh, well, one of my shows has just been at 30 countries. And I'll go, son of a gun.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I'll start calling up a little like Fiji or,
that's
you know,
funny. We got to get into more countries.
I need another country. I'll give you it for free.
And how was it going? Because I mentioned film just a while ago. I'll Be Back Before Midnight. So that was a huge hit theatrically. How was the process to take it to film? How did that happen?
Well, it was the usual disappointment that one has.
It must have started out as an exciting thing.
Oh, it was exciting.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of auditions, and we saw some fabulous actors.
So were you involved as a producer?
Yes.
Oh.
I was actually associate Wow. Producer. Only so that I wouldn't be thrown off the set.
Right. So not like you're investing your own money in it.
No, no.
Right.
No. The famous rule, remember that line from the producers, the two rules of theater? The first rule is never put your own money into the theater. The second rule is never put your own money into the theater.
Right. That's very good. Yeah. So you got on as an associate producer.
Right.
And they purchased the rights to make a film.
Right. And then they have all of
they can do whatever they want.
They can mess it up as much as they want. And we didn't use anybody from the auditions. Everybody was just a name that was offered the role.
Right.
Heather Locklear played cute little Jan, who was actually great fun to work with.
And Ned Beatty.
Ned Beatty played George.
Yeah. Did it
Robert
end up opening?
Carradine.
Sorry, did it open up theatrically or?
Not in North America.
Huh.
I think it did theatrical in various countries. I mean, it made quite a bit of money.
So it actually recouped its initial cost?
I'm told. The producers, do they ever tell the truth? I don't know.
No, you're right. In the film business, for sure.
But it wasn't the you know, it was reset in California. And it's like, because there was a place there to shoot it locally.
Right.
Really taking it away from its kind of gothic Victorian roots.
And did you have to fight again? Or were you in a position to fight for that when you saw them dismantling your script?
Well, no, I knew the game.
Yeah.
I knew the routine.
It's hard. It's got to be hard, though, to let that go, no?
It is. It is. But I knew one way or the other it was going to happen. Right. So, you know, pick your devil.
Yeah.
But it was a fun experience. But it made me realize that I really want to do live theater where I can control the script.
Right.
Because for me, I'm always improving a script. Crazy though it may seem, one of the reasons I come to see Midnight so many times is I'm rewriting it.
Hmm.
I mean, 30 years later, I'm rewriting it.
Yeah, that's
constantly. Cool. I did a big rewrite last year because we did it in Los Angeles where it was very well received. And I did a rewrite after that. And even in this production, I've seen a few little nuances that I think, you know, I'll put in that.
Has anyone ever got back to you about a rewrite and said, why did you change it? We liked it the old way? Is that ever?
Oh, yes. Yeah. In the early days when I did it, I did a major change in about between the first production and the second production. And it was because of Bill Glasgow at the Tarragon. The Tarragon wanted to do it, which I thought was, well, okay. They're not quite their style.
Yeah, popular. The Tarragon's not a place where popular modern theater
exactly.
goes. Yeah. And murder mystery. Is it okay to call
yeah,
it?
Yes, yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Murder mystery. Yeah. Suspense plays. They don't do that.
Yeah.
And Bill Glasgow was a very prestigious name. You know, he was like one of the top names in sort of the development of Canadian theater. And there was a certain element in Midnight of... should we say brother and sister, something was going on.
Okay.
In the original, it was like an adopted sister.
Ah. So you get that bye.
Yeah. So okay. Bill Glasgow said, for the, you know, he said, oh, you're just copping out. You got to go there.
Ooh.
I'm not sure if it's the right genre for going that distance. So what ended up is I have two versions.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And in fact, they're doing here, they're doing the softer
I gotcha.
Version.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's not vital to the script. But I find that the urban, you know, if it's like an edgy urban theater, they want to turn it into some dark thing, you know, with strange sexual overtones.
Yeah.
Go for it. But out here in the hinterland, it's like we're going back to the original.
Sure. Yeah. It doesn't make sense. Yeah. That's fascinating. That is. So you are very, very open to the market.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. I mean, for me, you know what I love so much about the business is it's the people. It's the audience.
Yeah.
I love that audience. And, you know, they're my people.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about theater is if you listen, your audience is going to talk to you. You're going to hear them every night in every performance, and you can see what works. And if you are, as you said, malleable and not stubborn-headed, you know, you can develop something that's going to be popular. And it sounds like that's you've been able to turn that into a nice living.
Yes. I mean, it's,
it's pretty,
you know, it goes up and down.
It goes up and down,
but,
yeah.
You know, I've never been in debt.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got a Mercedes.
Yeah, in Los Angeles.
A very old one.
In California.
Actually, I'm in a really nice house and a good life by being frugal in certain ways and having, you know, just enough money to put away something for retirement.
And I think of you at Western sending those letters to your father with the reviews from whatever newspaper was to just to sort of show, hey, this is working out. Did he ever get a chance to see your success as a playwright?
No, sadly. He never even saw my show that was in England.
Hmm.
That time he was in ill health. and found traveling difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really wanted to bring him down to see the one I had at university because that wasn't far from home.
So you're talking when I'll Be Back Before Midnight was at Cambridge? Is that the
Oh, no. Okay. This was my very first show in England. It was called The Saga of Reagan, oddly enough.
The Saga of Reagan?
Yeah. Okay. It wasn't spelled differently.
Gotcha.
It was a kind of a take on Tolkien.
Okay.
A bit of a spoof, a bit of a kind of a modernistic fairy tale for adults.
Yeah.
And it was great fun. It was very well received. The audiences loved it. And it was a bit irreverent. It was a bit Python-esque. You know, it was like if you mix Python and Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
So a bit of stream of consciousness in a sort of fantasy world.
Right, right, yeah. And it was perfect for the times.
Hmm.
You know, so the university crowd, because the theater was right near the university, just loved it. So yeah, that was the very first show I ever did, and of course everything's like leapfrogs off another. Yeah. The review I got from that got me the grand gig, and the grand gig got me the.
So your
live
dad was
gig.
Aware of the success.
But
he didn't get to see.
Oh,
the show.
Yeah. No, he went around to the local pubs with press clippings and bored everybody to death.
Oh, that's.
He never praised me, but all his friends told me. He says he just never shuts up about everything you're doing.
Oh, so he wouldn't tell you directly.
No, he. Military fellows, they can't praise.
No, I had that experience with my father too. It was in Hong Kong actually, and we were he had left Canada to go and work in Hong Kong, and I went to visit him for Christmas time, and it was not too far from the Hong Kong Fringe Festival. So I'm like, I might as well. I didn't have a real job. I'm like, I might as well perform at the Fringe Festival because I'd done some of the circuit in Canada. So I called up my buddy whose mother worked for an airline so he could fly for free, basically. I mean, you got to come out to Hong Kong. My dad's got a great big place. We can do our show at the Fringe in Hong Kong. And I had that relationship with my father that you're talking about. Never knew anything about how I ranked in his world, really, right. At the end of the day, right? And then I remember I was driving with one of his buddies, Peter. And Peter, we were driving, it was probably a Mercedes, one of those cars people have in Hong Kong. And he says to me, I don't know why he said it to me, but he says, you know, your father's really proud of you. And I'm like, I don't really know that. It was a bizarre time, yeah.
Wow. And what was your dad's background? Was he from an austere kind of...
Yeah, he was born in Czechoslovakia. His mother died. I don't know how she died when he was very young. So he was brought up just by his father, by himself, in really difficult times in Prague. And then immigrated to, escaped from Prague, went to Germany, then Holland, re-educated himself, came to Canada, but worked as a laborer. And when he first came... with my mother, and then sort of worked his way up into middle management with the Bell Telephone, the telephone company. But he was like, your dad, super hardworking, and I guess, you know, didn't probably recognize, or I guess obviously he did recognize what I was up to, but didn't know how to, other than getting me to enter, because I did magic and stuff like that when I was a kid. So he'd get me to do magic tricks for his friend, or for his friends. Oh, Keith Jordan, exactly like your father would be boring. His friends with your yes. reviews, my father would, if you know, depending on the situation, would pull me over and get me to do a couple of card tricks before the poker game or something. So I wouldn't know, you know, because you're young, you don't really realize it. But then when someone actually says it to you, you go, oh, okay. Yeah.
Maybe it's that old European tradition that you, spare the rod and spoil the child.
Yeah.
If you praise a child too much, then they'll become lazy.
Well, that's where we are now in society. I mean, it's that joke in the movie with Jack Nicholson, directed by, I can't think of, I'm blacking out here. Anyway, the guy goes to his there's a man courting his daughter, and he goes to his house and he goes to his bedroom, and he's got a ton of certificates and awards, and he looks at them, and it all's like participant, you know, they're all like not first place, second place, third place, just participant badges, you know, and all those kind of that we do with the kids today. You know,
it's
I see
the
it
esteemia, self-esteemia, yeah. as they call it.
Yeah. So we had a different world now than the one obviously we kind of had with our parents, for sure.
Yeah, I think they felt, especially with boys, that you had to steal them.
Yeah.
Make them hard.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And anything that was too soft or woman-like, you know, the women always praised.
Yeah, that's right.
Seemed. But the men, no, that's not my job.
Yeah, it's fun. And I think it's changed. I don't know, but I get the sense that it's changed. So, and then the one last question is just before we go, because thank you so much for giving us so much time. Throughout this crazy ups and downs and traveling around, this married to the same person for a long time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How did she deal with it all?
Oh, she loves it.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was a theater sort of addict growing up. She was born in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Her dad's a doctor, and her mother worked at the Royal Ontario Museum and various other museums. And they took her to see the theater at the Neptune.
Yeah, of course. Beautiful
theater.
She
just loved it. And so when she went west, and the first thing she did, I mean, we met in like her first 2 or 3 weeks there. She was this little frosh girl, you know.
Yeah.
And she auditioned for me as a dancer and singer. I was directing Oh, What a Lovely War, I think. And it was one of those instant things. She had a crush on me, and I sort of kept, you know, I thought, she's got something magical.
Yeah, yeah.
And we hung around for a little bit, and next thing you knew, we were an item.
And the hard times when you go back to that time in London, so you've had the great success, and then you're sort of now the winter of your discontent, and you were obviously unhappy, but that didn't sever the relationship. It never got that bad,
the lack of artistic success. The worst things got the closer we became.
Oh, that's great.
Because after Weston, she went to McMaster and Mohawk for her physio stuff. So we were living
a little bit apart.
A little bit apart.
Yeah.
So we would see each other every single weekend. But she always believed in me.
Yeah.
Completely.
That's great.
And she loved the idea, you know, of being part of a sort of a creative life, even though she's not, you know, creative in that sense herself. She's a wonderful proofreader, and she can spell, and I can't.
Because of the dyslexia.
I can't spell, even today.
Yeah.
You know, I learned German as a kid, which is phonetic.
Hmm.
And then when I was, you know, learning English about the same time, I thought, this is mad. This language is insane.
It's got
Well, there's no rules to it, and then there's exceptions to rules. So she's been very, very useful over the years. And if she doesn't get something, you know, she'll tell me.
Let you know.
Yeah,
well, that's great. So you have a partnership, like an honest partnership, and in terms of the creative process, she's there, part of your and it sounds like an integral part of the creative process.
Oh, totally. I mean, I rely on her reaction to things. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'll bristle a little bit and say, what do you mean you didn't get it? I mean, it's like, it's so obvious. And then it'll dawn on me that she's right. Of course.
That's how it all ends. I got to tell you, Peter, they're always right. That's the end of the day.
That's the first rule of a good marriage is she's always right.
That's exactly. Well, I'm glad that you, that's part of probably this. The reason you guys have lasted so long.
I think so.
I love that. Hey, thank you so much for taking the time to just talk about your success. And I just love the fact that the Western, where I am now, was part of your, and London, Ontario, was part of your...
It's every time I wake up and I look at my wife, she was my little Western girl.
Wow. You know, so. And anything that we can look forward to in terms of your next piece? The Lighthouse.
The Lighthouse, if it will be, like I said, we're workshopping it this year, but if it does get picked up, keeping my fingers crossed that my writing will be good enough. It would be the following summer in Port Dover.
Okay.
And there is talk of possibly a co-productions with other theaters, but that's just talk right now.
So we'll keep our eyes open for that.
Yeah. So if you like, you know, it's kind of a gothic thriller with some comedy and a little bit of sex thrown in.
Of course.
Stuck in a lighthouse, you know. A little island with the winds raging and the foghorn blaring and the lightning crashing.
I love it. And then in the wintertime, you're going to get the pantomimes going in Los Angeles, in California, rather?
Well, like I said, they've already made a start.
They're going.
The pantos at Pasadena are very popular, and I'm certainly spreading the gospel. Yeah. Like you theater companies, if you want to make your nut for the year.
Yeah, do that.
You can do it in December.
And introduce a new...
and a whole new generation.
Yeah, that's what it's all about, yeah. All right, thank you so much, Peter.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
This was very interesting. You're a great interviewer.
Well, thank you. Well, there you go. Peter Colley has left the building. Now I'm back in my suburban basement spare room. It's just me and you. Hey, thanks so much for listening to that. It's a bit longer than normal. I hope you got a kick out of it. I hope it inspired you. I left that interview and I'm like, I have to write a play. He just makes it seem like so much fun and such an interesting occupation. And I know writing has got to be the hardest and one of the most lonely things to do in the arts. But what a story he's got there. And nice to share all that stuff with our fathers too. And, you know, I'm growing up. I'm a father now. I'm still trying to figure it out. So that was nice to get some... insights into his life and how supportive his father was. If you haven't already, do me a huge favor. Visit iTunes. Go to the iTunes store. Check out. It'll help me with the podcast. It'll help more people listen to the podcast. If you go to the iTunes store and then type in The Inadequate Life, find the podcast. It'll be a little button on your left-hand side. There'll be a picture.
and give us a review. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stars. The more people that review it, the higher up it ranks in iTunes search results. So that's really cool. And you can also subscribe to it right there, and it'll go to your iPhone or your iPad or your iPod, whatever you have. It'll go there automatically. And I'm an Android guy. I say that. I use a different podcatcher, but whatever you have, please subscribe to it on iTunes. It helps a lot. Thanks very much. We'll see you next week. I'm going to come right back next week with another podcast. Someone who's playing at the Stratford Summer Music Festival. That's coming up next week on The Inadequate Life.